Numbers, chapters 33, 34, 35, and 36. The 16th and final talk in a series on Numbers was presented by David Crabtree on June 2, 2019 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by David Crabtree and is being made available to you by Gutenberg College. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. Contributions to David Crabtree may be made at www.soundinterp.wordpress.com. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. Handout number 16, numbers 33, 34, 35, and 36 accompanies this talk.
We're going to do the last chunk of Numbers today. We're going to do the last four chapters. The last four chapters, I think it's ending in an optimistic note, if I'm understanding it correctly. There is the question, why were these pieces put here in the end? Two of them could have been put in other places, but they were put here. And that question of why the different chunks in Numbers are placed where they are placed has been a problem throughout the throughout the book. And so I'll make my proposal as to why these are here and what is the continuity of thought that runs through them at the end, my conclusion. I am not going to read all of these chapters. I'm going to read very little of chapter 33 and not very much of 34. But let me tell you what is in these chapters. Chapter 33 goes through and names all of the camp, I shouldn't say all, it names the camping spots where they stopped on their journey from Egypt, so starting with the beginning of the Exodus. It starts in Egypt and follows all the way through to the plains of Moab. So this lists their camping spots, their stopping places. People who know more than I do think that this is not a complete list. They think that there are probably places that have been left out of this, but it is just a basically a charting out of their itinerary. It has been noted by some, especially Wenham, that this is very symmetrical. He points out that if you list all of the places where they stopped, they come in groups of seven, and there are six groups. So six groups of seven. And he says that's very coincidental. It's significant because it's analogous to what happens in the genealogies in Matthew, where Matthew goes out of his way to point out that there are three groups of 14. If you were to break that down, that would be equivalent to six groups of seven. And so he sees significance in that. I'm not sure. So most of this section then is just an itinerary, and it's all worded very monotonously. It will say, and they journeyed from X and camped in Y. Then they journeyed from Y and camped in Z. That's the format throughout the whole chapter, with very little outside additional comment. There are only a handful of places where he makes extra comment. For example, there were 12 springs of water and 70 palm trees at one site. Another one, it was there, the people had no water. But otherwise, there is no commentary really, except for two spots, and I'll talk about those in just a minute. I am sure that for those who were involved in this trip, that every spot conjured up memories. I remember that this was a very long time ago. It was when I was 10 years old, our family took a trip by car from Klamath Falls, Oregon to New York City. And I remembered that trip very well for a long time, and I could have told you every place that we stopped and all of the key events that happened between each stop. And I could have told you that for years after, but no longer. But I'm sure that the people who were on this trip, they would have remembered well the things that the places where they stopped, and that would have conjured up the whole trip. And so this makes a very fitting conclusion to the end of Exodus and Numbers, because it is charting out the trip described in Exodus as well as Numbers. Okay, I said that there are two places where there's a little bit of additional commentary, and I'll just read those verses. The first one is in chapter 33, verses, let's start with 3. And they journeyed from Ramses in the first month, on the 15th day of the first month, on the next day after the Passover, the sons of Israel started out boldly in the sight of all the Egyptians, while the Egyptians were burying all their firstborn, whom the Lord had struck down among them. The Lord had also executed judgments on their gods. So this is, comparatively speaking, this is a lot of commentary right at the very beginning. And I want to point out two things. One is they started out boldly, and literally that's with an upraised hand. We've seen that phrase used two or three times in Numbers. Doing something with an upraised hand means to do it boldly. If it's sin, it's to sin defiantly. But in this case, it's not sinning, it's just leaving Egypt with boldness. They aren't leaving like slaves. They're leaving like victors. And I think that's what's being underscored here. And while they're leaving, the Egyptians are burying all of their firstborn. So the contrast is very stark. They're leaving the place of their slavery with an upraised hand, and their masters are burying their firstborn. And the Lord had also executed judgments on their gods. It was a victory over their gods as well. So they're leaving as victors, and I think that's the point of that commentary at the beginning of the chapter. The other place that there's commentary is in verse 38 through 40, and I'll read that. Then Aaron the priest went up to Mount Hor at the command of the Lord and died there in the 40th year after the sons of Israel had come from the land of Egypt on the first day in the fifth month. And Aaron was 123 years old when he died on Mount Hor. Now the Canaanite, the king of Arad, who lived in the Negev in the land of Canaan, heard of the coming of the sons of Israel. Now, it doesn't say what happened there, but we know from the narrative earlier, what happened there is the Israelites fought against the Canaanites and they defeated them. These verses are marking the point at which they stop wandering in the wilderness and they start to move towards the promised land. So this is the left-hand turn that they're making towards the promised land after circling for 40 years. So I think that's at the same time at which Aaron the priest died, which suggests the end of the older generation. So the older generation has died out, and they have their first victory as they begin their march towards the promised land now. Okay, I will read verses 50 through 56. Then the Lord spoke to Moses in the plains of Moab by the Jordan opposite Jericho, saying, "Speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when you cross over the Jordan into the land of Canaan, then you shall drive out all the inhabitants of the land from before you and destroy all their figured stones and destroy all their molten images and demolish all their high places. And you shall take possession of the land and live in it, for I have given the land to you to possess it. And you shall inherit the land by lot according to your families. To the larger you shall give more inheritance, and to the smaller you shall give less inheritance. Wherever the lot falls to anyone, that shall be his. You shall inherit according to the tribes of your fathers. But if you do not drive out the inhabitants of the land from before you, then it shall come about that those whom you let remain of them will become as pricks in your eyes and as thorns in your sides, and they shall trouble you in the land in which you live. And it shall come about that as I plan to do to them, so I will do to you." This is just talking about the upcoming conquest of the promised land. They're going to go in, and they are going to conquer it. Those are the instructions that they have been given. And this is the first statement with respect to the rules of engagement that they will have when they go into Canaan. There will be more rules of engagement given, more specifics given, once they actually get into the land. And Joshua will give them at various times instructions as to how they are supposed to conduct themselves in the battles and what they're supposed to do with the plunder that they take. And we noticed last week the battle that they had, that some, the division of the booty then was done according to those rules that they would later be given in Joshua. So that there are hints already of how they are supposed to engage the Canaanites when they go into the land. The emphasis here, however, is on the destruction of all religious items. Anything that's associated with idolatry is supposed to be destroyed. So the promised land needs to be an idolatry-free zone, and all traces of it are supposed to be expunged. They are to go in, and they are to possess the land, and in possessing it, that land will be allocated. Land will be allocated to each family. And as we talked about before, there's proportionality. That is, the bigger families will get more. But there's also a randomness to it, that the individual lots will be given by drawing lots, by casting lots. So it's both proportional in some sense, and it is by lots. It's random. And the land will be divided up by tribe. Each tribe will get a certain area. At the end of this section, then it warns them that they are supposed to drive the Canaanites out completely. Any that they leave will be a nagging problem. So it's like finding dry rot when you're doing remodeling. You've got to get it all out. If you don't, it's coming back. It'll come back to haunt you. And similarly, the Canaanites have to be driven out. There has to be a complete transformation of the land and the culture, a cultural and spiritual transformation of the land needs to take place. Chapter 34. Now again, I'm not going to read this, at least not the first 15 verses. The first 15 verses just chart out the land that is that they are being given. So it's the promised land is being charted out. Unfortunately, there are a number of names of cities and geographical features that we don't even know where they're located. So it's difficult to chart it out. But it charts it out, the southern border, western border, northern border, and eastern border. Presumably, as it goes around, it is not including the Transjordan. It's not clear because that's where most of the names that are not identifiable are located in this charting out. But it says in verse 13, so Moses commanded the sons of Israel, saying, this is the land that you are to apportion by lot among you as a possession, which the Lord has commanded to give to the 9.5 tribes. So this is the land that's just going to the 9.5 tribes. It's Transjordan that was going to the other 2.5 tribes. And apparently that's already been given out. Verse 16 then, I won't read this either. Verse 16 through 29 then lists the people who will be responsible for giving out these plots of land. In particular, it's going to be Eleazar, the high priest. It's going to be Joshua, who is Moses' successor, and a leader from each of the tribes. And it goes through and lists them. And I think it only lists the 9 tribes, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah. No, 10 tribes. The only name in this list that we've seen before, that's been mentioned before in Numbers, is Caleb. Caleb is the leader of Judah. That's the only name here that is repeated. The others are all new leaders that we have not seen mention of in the rest of Numbers. Okay, chapter 35 then. We're moving along quickly here. Verses 1-8. Now the Lord spoke to Moses in the plains of Moab by the Jordan, opposite Jericho, saying, command the sons of Israel that they give to the Levites from the inheritance of their possession cities to live in. And you shall give to the Levites pasture lands around the cities, and the cities shall be theirs to live in, and their pasture lands shall be for their cattle and for their herds and for all their beasts. And the pasture lands of the cities which you shall give to the Levites shall extend from the wall of the city outward 1,000 cubits around. You shall also measure the outside of the city on the east side 2,000 cubits, and on the south side 2,000 cubits, and on the west side 2,000 cubits, and on the north side 2,000 cubits, with the city in the center. This shall become theirs as pasture lands for the cities. And the cities which you shall give to the Levites shall be the 6 cities of refuge, which you shall give for the manslayer to flee to. And in addition to them, you shall give 42 cities. All the cities which you shall give to the Levites shall be 48 cities together with their pasture lands. As for the cities which you shall give from the possession of the sons of Israel, you shall take more from the larger, and you shall take less from the smaller. Each shall give some of his cities to the Levites in proportion to his possession, which he inherits. So we've talked about how the land will be given out to the people of Israel, except for one tribe, and that's the tribe of the Levites. And I assume that here when they talk about Levites, they're talking about the tribe of the Levites. So it includes both Levites and priests. The land that they are going to be given, what the provision for them, I should say, is they are going to get a bunch of cities. They're going to get, 42 plus 6. So they're going to get 48 cities total, scattered all over the land. Each tribe will give up a few cities for the Levites to live in. Now, presumably, these other people can live in these cities, but these are to be Levitical cities. These are cities that are allocated for the Levites to live in. And each city will have a border of land around it that will be used by the Levites to pasture their flocks. So they'll have cattle, they'll have sheep, I don't know what all else, but they'll be able to pasture those on pieces of land just outside the city. And the amount of land that's supposed to be allocated for that purpose is a square of land that's 2,000 cubits on a side, which means about a half a mile. So it's about a half mile square of land just all around the city that is reserved for the Levites to pasture their animals in. Six of those cities are cities of refuge. And verse 9 through the end of the chapter then is going to talk about these cities of refuge. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when you cross the Jordan into the land of Canaan, then you shall select for yourselves cities to be your cities of refuge, that the manslayer who has killed any person unintentionally may flee there. And the city shall be to you as a refuge from the avenger, so that the manslayer may not die until he stands before the congregation for trial. And the cities which you are to give shall be your six cities of refuge. And you shall give three cities across the Jordan and three cities in the land of Canaan. They are to be cities of refuge. These six cities shall be for refuge for the sons of Israel and for the alien and for the sojourner among them, that anyone who kills a person unintentionally may flee there." So there will be six special cities established, three of them in the Transjordan and three of them in Canaan proper. And these cities, the purpose, and these will all be Levitical cities. The purpose of these cities is to provide refuge for anyone who unintentionally takes the life of another person. Typically in the ancient world, especially in the nomadic part of the ancient world, if someone is killed, it doesn't matter whether it was intentional or unintentional. It is the obligation of a person that in Hebrew is called the goel, and I'll talk about that in just a minute. It is the responsibility of the goel of that family to kill whoever did it, to get vengeance on whoever did it. And that seems to be a common feature of certainly nomadic, of the nomadic world, but of ancient cultures in general, that apparently the idea is whenever anything bad happens to your family, it is important to strike back and strike back hard so it never happens again. So you don't worry about whether it was intentional or not. We aren't going to have a trial. There'll be no pieces of evidence, no witnesses. We're just killing the person who did it so that nobody ever does that again. Well, apparently there was that ethos among the Hebrews as well. But a city of refuge is a means by which that can be changed. And the way that that's changed is if someone kills another unintentionally, they can flee to their city of refuge and be safe. And it'll talk about how that happens in just a minute. But it talks about the avenger. In verse 12, "And the city shall be to you as a refuge from the avenger." The word there is goel. The goel in Hebrew culture, that is a person who, and I don't know if there's an official designation or exactly how this works, but every extended family will have a goel. And it is the responsibility of that goel to look out for the welfare of the entire extended family. And if anyone in that entire extended family is in trouble for one reason or another, then it is the goel's responsibility to step in and address the problem. So, for instance, if someone in the extended family gets sold into slavery, It is the Goel's responsibility to go buy them out of slavery. In this case, if someone gets killed, it's a responsibility of the Goel to get vengeance for the one who was killed. So the city of refuge is a refuge from that avenger. It's that family avenger coming and killing the one who had killed someone else unintentionally. All right, it's going to describe this a little bit more. Verse 16. But if he struck him down with an iron object so that he died, he is a murderer. The murderer shall surely be put to death. And if he struck him down with a stone in the hand by which he may die, and as a result he died, he is a murderer. The murderer shall surely be put to death. Or if he struck him with a wooden object in the hand by which he may die, and as a result he died, he is a murderer. The murderer shall surely be put to death. The blood avenger himself shall put the murderer to death. He shall put him to death when he meets him. And if he pushed him of hatred or threw something at him lying in wait, and as a result he died, or if he struck him down with his hand in enmity, and as a result he died, the one who struck him shall surely be put to death. He is a murderer. The blood avenger shall put the murderer to death when he meets him. So this section is talking about intentional murder. If someone strikes another person with a deadly weapon so that he might die, and he does die, then that is murder. And that person needs to die. If he was angry at the person that he struck and struck him such that he dies, then that's a murder. Or if he strikes him with something other than a deadly weapon, but he does so with the intent that the person dies, then that's a murder and he needs to be put to death. And it has been given, the responsibility for putting him to death has been given to the Goel to carry that out. Verse 22 now and following is going to talk about the unintentional murder. But if he pushed him suddenly without enmity or threw something at him without lying in wait, or with any deadly object of stone and without seeing it dropping on him so that he died, while he was not his enemy nor seeking his injury, then the congregation shall judge between the slayer and the blood avenger according to these ordinances. And the congregation shall deliver the manslayer from the hand of the blood avenger, and the congregation shall restore him to his city of refuge to which he fled. And he shall live in it until the death of the high priest who is anointed with the holy oil. But if the manslayer shall at any time go beyond the border of his city of refuge to which he may flee, and the blood avenger finds him outside the border of his city of refuge, and the blood avenger kills the manslayer, he shall not be guilty of blood, because he should have remained in his city of refuge until the death of the high priest. But after the death of the high priest, the manslayer shall return to the land of his possession. Interesting, an interesting provision here. So this is unintentional murder. He didn't mean to push somebody, but he pushes him and the guy dies. That is unintentional murder. Or even if he uses an object that is potentially deadly, but he had no way of knowing that it was going to strike the person and kill him, then that's unintentional murder. In those cases, when it's unintentional murder, then the congregation is called, and it's not clear which congregation it is. I assume it's the congregation at the city of refuge, but I don't know that for sure. The congregation then judges between the slayer and the blood avenger, according to these ordinances. So they make the decision as to whether this was intentional or unintentional. If it was unintentional, then the person who unintentionally murdered another, he has to stay in this city of refuge. He will be safe there. And he has to stay there until the death of the current high priest. He has to wait until that high priest dies. Once that high priest dies, he's free to go. If he tries to sneak out of the city earlier than that, and the Goel sees him and kills him, the Goel will not be held guilty of murder. He just did what he should have done. So, the unintentional murderer has to stay in the city of refuge until the death of the high priest. Once that high priest dies, then he's free to go. He can return to his possession, his land. Verse 29, and these things shall be for a statutory ordinance to you throughout your generations in all your dwellings. If anyone kills a person, the murderer shall be put to death at the evidence of witnesses, but no person shall be put to death on the testimony of one witness. Moreover, you shall not take ransom for the life of a murderer who is guilty of death, but he shall surely be put to death. And you shall not take ransom for him who has fled to his city of refuge, that he may return to live in the land before the death of the priest. So you shall not pollute the land in which you are, for blood pollutes the land, and no expiation can be made for the land for the blood that is shed on it, except by the blood of him who shed it. And you shall not defile the land in which you live, in the midst of which I dwell, for I, the Lord, am dwelling in the midst of the sons of Israel. Okay, there are two things being added here. One is no one can be convicted of murder in the absence of witnesses, and it has to be more than one. In the absence of two or more witnesses, they can't be convicted. The other thing that it's adding is ransom. You cannot pay money to get out of the penalty. If you killed somebody, if you've murdered someone, you can't pay money to get out of the penalty. You have to die. If you unintentionally murdered someone, you can't pay money to get out of the city of refuge early. You have to wait until the high priest dies. So no ransom is possible. Nobody leaves. Nobody is free of their responsibility when someone is killed until there's a death. In the case of murder, the death of the murderer. In the case of unintentional killing, it's the high priest. That's because God says, you shall not pollute the land in which you are, and blood pollutes the land. The land needs to be pure because, verse 34, and you shall not defile the land in which you live, in the midst of which I dwell, for I, the Lord, am dwelling in the midst of the sons of Israel. And that's been such an important theme throughout Numbers, but even going back to Exodus. The Israelites wanted God to dwell in their midst, to be in their midst. And God's saying, that's what I'm doing, but if I'm going to dwell in your midst, the land has to be pure. Verse 36 now changes gears. It's a completely different topic. I'll read the first four verses. And the heads of the fathers' households of the family of the sons of Gilead, the son of Machir, the son of Manasseh, of the families of the son of Joseph, came near and spoke before Moses and before the leaders, the heads of the fathers' households of the sons of Israel. And they said, "The Lord commanded my Lord to give the land by lot to the sons of Israel as an inheritance. And my Lord was commanded by the Lord to give the inheritance of Zelophehad, our brother, to his daughters. But if they marry one of the sons of the other tribes of the sons of Israel, their inheritance will be withdrawn from the inheritance of our fathers and will be added to the inheritance of the tribe to which they belong. Thus it will be withdrawn from our allotted inheritance. And when the jubilee of the sons of Israel comes, then their inheritance will be added to the inheritance of the tribe to which they belong. So their inheritance will be withdrawn from the inheritance of the tribe of our fathers." Okay, if you'll recall back a few chapters, the daughters of Zelophehad came to Moses, and they pointed out to Moses that their father had given birth only to daughters. He had no sons. And that creates a problem because once Zelophehad dies, then there will be no one to carry on in his family. No, he will have no descendants to carry on his name with a possession, with land. So they brought this concern to Moses. Moses took it to God, and God said, in this case, the daughters will inherit land from Zelophehad. Okay, so that solved that problem. Now we've got a different problem. And the problem here is, it's not the daughters that are coming to bring this problem. It's the heads of the tribe that are bringing this problem of Manasseh. They're bringing this problem, and they're saying, that has created another difficulty. Because now the ones who will inherit are the daughters. But if they go and marry someone from another tribe, then that land will be removed from the tribe of Manasseh, and it will go to the tribe of whoever they marry. So that land will be removed from the tribe of Manasseh, and that's not good. So that's the problem that they are bringing to Moses. Verse 5. Then Moses commanded the sons of Israel according to the word of the Lord, saying, "The tribe of the sons of Joseph are right in their statements. This is what the Lord has commanded concerning the daughters of Zelophehad, saying, let them marry whom they wish, only they must marry within the family of the tribe of their father. Thus no inheritance of the sons of Israel shall be transferred from tribe to tribe, for the sons of Israel shall each hold to the inheritance of the tribe of his fathers. And every daughter who comes into possession of an inheritance from any tribe of the sons of Israel shall be wife to one of the family of the tribe of her father, so that the sons of Israel each may possess the inheritance of his fathers. Thus no inheritance shall be transferred from one tribe to another tribe, for the tribes of the sons of Israel shall each hold to his own inheritance." So Moses refers this concern to God. God agrees this is a problem, and God's solution to this is the daughters of Zelophehad, they can marry whoever they want as long as they marry someone from the tribe of Manasseh. And if they will do that, then the problem is solved. No one outside the tribe of Manasseh will inherit that land. Verse 10, just as the Lord had commanded Moses, so the daughters of Zelophehad did. Mahla, Tirzah, Hogla, Milcah, and Noah, the daughters of Zelophehad, married their uncle's sons. They married those from the families of the sons of Manasseh, the son of Joseph, and their inheritance remained with the tribe of the family of their father. So they did what they were instructed to do, and the land allocated to the tribe of Manasseh stayed with the tribe of Manasseh. Then the last verse, summing up the book, these are the commandments and the ordinances which the Lord commanded to the sons of Israel through Moses in the plains of Moab by the Jordan opposite Jericho. Now this sets it up for the next book coming up, Deuteronomy, when Moses is going to give his last speech to the people of Israel on the plains of Moab. And then Moses will die, and then after that, the Israelites will go into the land and start conquering it. Okay. Is there a discernible thought, train of thought, in these last four chapters? As I've said before, and as I said at the very beginning, there are some people who think that Numbers is just a bunch of random things thrown together. They say it's very disorganized. There is a historical narrative that is kind of running through the book, but there are these odd pieces of law and other things that are thrown in that seem to have no rhyme nor reason. Sometimes, therefore, commentators say, well, there is just random. There is no continuity of thought to be found. Others find explanation in why a passage occurs where it occurs by kind of superficial connections. A word in passage A is repeated in passage B, but there's no other connecting thing. It's just a device that's used to connect them. It's not a train of thought. I'm not inclined to go in that direction, in either direction, in the direction of thinking that it's random or in the direction of looking for just superficial connections between chunks. It seems to me that to go for those explanations, unless there is no other explanation, is punting too soon. And if you punt too soon, you'll never find the continuity of thought. The commentators that I have used typically do try to find some kind of continuity of thought, and some of their explanations are extremely complex, and I find them so complex as to be not very satisfying either. But some of them have found some connections that I thought were very helpful. In these four chapters, I would have to say that my commentators have let me down, and they don't really find continuity here. But I think there is a thread of continuity that's running through these, and this is what I am proposing for the continuity of thought running through these four chapters. In chapter 33, we have a review of the camps where the Israelites stayed on their journey through the wilderness. And it is a fitting end to that journey to now, as we're getting at the end, to look back on that and to remember what they have come through, what has happened. And I am confident that the younger generation would have retained memories and remembered stories that their parents had told with respect to that journey and what had happened. It is interesting that in this chapter, their sins go unmentioned. There's no emphasis put on places where they were unfaithful. Nor is there any emphasis put on Mount Sinai, which I think is very strange, is surprising. The only places that are emphasized with commentary are the two that I talked about, when they leave Egypt, and when they make that turn towards the promised land. So chapter 33 then is just looking back at what has happened and how did we get here. The end of 33 through the first part of 35, then, is telling the Israelites how they are supposed to possess the land and a description of that land. This is what we were coming for. This is what we were headed for ever since we left Egypt. This is the land, and we're going to go in, and there is provision made for how we will occupy it, how we will possess it. And each family is going to have their own plot of land in it. They're going to have their own homestead in this land. And the Levites, too, will have their, they won't have a plot of land, but there will be provision for them in this land. They will be occupants of cities, and six of those cities will be the cities of refuge. So the next section then focuses on those cities of refuge. And in talking about the cities of refuge, it explains what those cities of refuge are for. And what those cities of refuge are for is a place where an unintentional killer can flee for safety. Now, that means that there is a disposition that is required for anyone who kills another person. If it's murder, then they have to be, the murderer needs to be killed. If it's unintentional killing, then they can flee to the city of refuge. But purity has to be maintained. This land that you're going in to possess is one in which I, God, will dwell in your midst, and purity must be maintained. And the laws with respect to murder are one example of how that purity has to be maintained. Then the last chapter about the daughters of Zelophehad, this one in some ways could have been moved. It could have been right after the other section about the daughters of Zelophehad. In some ways that would have been more logical. But it's not there. It was moved here, and I think it serves a different purpose. There it served the purpose of showing that the daughters of Zelophehad came with a reasonable request to Moses for him to think over and to adjudicate. A very different kind of response than we had seen from the older generation when they saw problems. Here, however, the emphasis is on inheritance that is not secured for the tribe. And what we see is God wants the inheritance of the tribe to be kept intact just as much as the heads of that tribe want to see it intact. They want to make sure that their tribe maintains the inheritance that was given to it by God. And therefore the provision is made that they should marry within the family. So I'll summarize these four chapters. These chapters are all about entering and possessing the land that they have come so far to get. Each family will get their own homestead, but they, for their part, must be careful to keep the land free of pollution. And God, on his part, will make arrangements to keep their allotments secure for the family to enjoy indefinitely. So I think that's what's happening at the end of the book of Numbers. And it's an optimistic ending. They're here. They can see the land from the plains of Moab. And arrangements are being made for how that will be divvied up among them. They are going to go in and possess it. They're going to reach the goal that they've been aiming for so many years. Okay, I want to take just a little bit of time to talk about the significance of Numbers for us today. There are a lot of things that I could say. I'm just going to talk about one thing But there are, I think, many significances of numbers for us today. As I have said before, and I won't defend it today, but I am convinced that you cannot apply a verse. When I teach, I don't do much application because there's a sense in which I don't believe in it. And the sense in which I don't believe in it is you can't take a verse, you can't take a passage and just apply it. You can only apply a worldview, a full worldview, a reasonably well-developed worldview, because it's only in that context that you can understand the individual commands, for instance, that are made. So application is a tricky thing. I've got some commentaries at home. I probably mentioned this. I've got some commentaries in the Application Bible Commentary series. And with each chapter, they go through and give you the applications for it. And I find it not helpful. They are so forced. They're trying to figure out how to apply each chapter, and it's very forced. So what I think has to happen is we have to study the Bible for the purpose of figuring out what is the biblical worldview. What is God's worldview? But what is the biblical worldview? I assume that they're synonymous. What is the biblical worldview? Now that's something that you can apply. And you can apply that anywhere and in myriads of ways. But you have to build that. And so in my thinking, that's what Bible study is all about, is trying to put together the pieces of the biblical worldview. And that's a big project. It's a difficult project. It's a complex project. But I'm convinced it is doable. So in Numbers, there are some things that we learn that are really important. It is an incredible look at the nature of God. God responding to his people. We see his mercy. We see his forgiveness. We see his patience. And yet we see his severity to a certain extent as well. We also see human beings and how they respond to God. Real live human beings, ones that we can identify with, I think. And what kind of God God is, and what kind of creatures we as human beings are, that has to be a cornerstone of any biblical worldview. As we watch the Israelites make their way through the wilderness, we see them facing the daily existential question that is essentially the one that we face on a day-to-day basis as well. For them, life was a series of hardships. It was one thing after another. And as I've pointed out before, it was, we're about to run out of X. We're about to run out of water. We're about to run out of food. We're about to run out of meat. Or, I'm tired of eating meat. I'm tired of eating manna, whatever. So they were in a place of scarcity. I mean, it's interesting that it's so typical that God took them out of Egypt and immediately put them in an environment of scarcity. They were running low on water after 3 days. So they're in an environment where they're constantly in fear of running out of water or food. They're bored with the monotony of the diet. And so they have plenty of grounds for discontent. And we can identify with that, I think. We too would be discontented. These conditions then constitute a test. Is how will I deal with my, and then we can put in any word we want. It could be discomfort, or we can escalate. It's misery, or we can escalate it even more. It's agony. How am I going to deal with this? And we know how to escalate those. Am I going to deal with it in faithfulness, or am I going to deal with it in faithlessness? In their situation, the question that they had to face when looking at this scarcity is, am I going to respond by thinking, I've got to get out of here. This is unbearable. This is craziness. I will do anything to get out of this, whatever it takes. That's the response of faithlessness. The response of faithfulness would be to look at this and say, this is a God-prescribed hardship that I'm facing. God got me here. I'm en route to a place that God wants to get me. And I know that God is a loving and almighty God. And as a result, my job is to work through this hardship faithfully and lawfully, that is, according to his principles, and then leave it up to God to provide and put things into perspective such that I can handle whatever monotony or boredom comes along. I can see it for what it is and set it aside. I have found looking at numbers extremely challenging and extremely helpful to look at what they have faced and to really think about me being in their shoes has been very helpful. And then to see God's patient response time after time after time is incredible, incredible. Okay, I'm done. There is time for questions, comments.
I have a question about near the end of chapter 35, when Moses, says not to accept a ransom for life or a ransom for anyone who has fled into a city of refuge and is waiting for the death of a high priest, and then finally a warning not to pollute the land with bloodshed.
Yes.
To the best of your knowledge, does any of that end up later becoming a problem in the history of Israel or later in the divided kingdom?
What do you mean by any of that?
Particularly on taking bribes to change the course of justice.
Okay. Yes. Taking bribes to affect the application of justice, that is something that is brought up by the prophets. So it does happen. It's condemned by them. Now, with respect to the killing people, that's another thing that the prophets talk about. They complain about the people of Jerusalem being murderers. I am suspicious that murder is seen as the ultimate form of disrespecting another person. To take someone's life is the most disrespectful that you can be towards another person. But there are other ways of being disrespectful. And I think that the prophets, in their minds, that is being murderous. You may not kill them, it may not be lethal, but it's murder. It is an act of disrespect towards other people. So I think that there's a sense in which this is just an example of a kind of disrespect or lack of love towards your neighbor, but that it really extends to the whole range of things that we do to people that are have the same spirit behind them.
A comment and then I'm interested in your feedback.
Okay.
I was really struck by the sense in which some of these passages violated our 21st century sense of justice.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking of a couple of fellows, we'll call them Bobsala and Josala, and one of them commits murder and accidentally, and he goes to the city of refuge, and 10 years later, the other one commits murder accidentally, and he goes to the city of refuge, and then the next year, the high priest dies.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a sense in which our sense of justice is sort of not satisfied, because Bobsala had to wait 11 years, and Josala only had to wait 1 year.
Right.
Right?
Right.
And it seems like there are other places, maybe not quite so, well, other places, obviously, that God really wanted the Israelites to wipe out the Canaanites, which sort of offends our sense of justice as well. And to a lesser extent, there's a sense in which the restrictions on the daughters to only marry within their tribe or something like that is also. But
right.
What strikes me about all of those cases is that it seems like God's interests or his priorities are on sort of the purity of the land and the purity of the Israelites in fulfilling the commands. And I mean, even the fact that waiting for the high priest to die in some sense, maybe, I don't know, you didn't comment on this, but whether that's like a kind of a foreshadowing or something like that, that justice is done when the high priest is dying for the other death or something like mm-hmm. that. I don't know, it just sort of strikes me as sort of a very much a purity in accordance with God's promises kind of a mentality as opposed to a fairness mentality. I don't know what your right. thoughts are on that.
Right. Yes. I think it is probably true that God doesn't care much about fairness. There are all kinds of things that you could point out in the Old Testament system where there is a lack of fairness. I mean, I was just thinking about giving out the plots of land. Oh, I was reading in Joshua. But Caleb's descendants get some land in the Negev. But they go back, they're concerned because they have these plots of land in the Negev, but they don't have water. So they arrange, they work it out so that they get water. Well, you're going to have plots of land that are all rock. Some people are going to get really good plots of land. Some are going to get less good plots of land. That's inevitable. And it's those kinds of unfairnesses are everywhere. And then they're part of life. I mean, it's not just the Old Testament system that has that. Just life in general is full of those kinds of unfairnesses where someone has some kind of seeming advantage. But we really aren't smart enough nor have the perspective to evaluate those unfairnesses, because something that we might think is very unfair could turn out to be a real benefit. Lot picked the well-watered land. Abraham got stuck with the dry hill country. And yet that was a benefit, not a detriment. So I think that we're encouraged to not worry about those kinds of things. Life is full of those unfairnesses. But so what? It doesn't matter.
Yeah, I mean, I could easily imagine God have said, you have to stay in the city of refuge for X number of years, as opposed to when the high priest died
right.
or something like that.
Right, right. No, there's symbolism happening there, I think. And exactly what that symbolism is, I'm not sure, but I think there's symbolism happening there.
A couple questions. One of them relates again to the city of refuge and the murder. It seems like further back in the Old Testament when the law was given out, there was more of an organized, centralized way of justice. I mean, we have these laws and people are to be stoned or this or that. And it seems like then there were people assigned or it came from the high priest or Moses or something. Is that true? I mean, I can't remember it, but further back in the
You mean in Exodus?
In Exodus and maybe Leviticus. It seems like it was more centralized, and now it's kind of going back to the families or the clans that are responsible.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Okay.
I'd have to look back at it with that in mind. Yeah. In Deuteronomy, things get more centralized, it seems to me.
Okay.
Whether that's true in Leviticus, I have not looked carefully at Leviticus yet.
Well, another thing relates to this idea of killing the Canaanites. It seems like the Philistines, I mean, this is very politically incorrect, but the Philistines lived in what is now the Gaza Strip.
Mm-hmm.
And if the Israelites had carried out all their commands to clear the land, it seems like they wouldn't have the problems they have today. But I mean, that's not a politically correct thing to say probably, but their troubles have carried on because they didn't carry out the commands that God gave them.
Right. Well, I think that's true. And that's what you see that in not in Joshua, but in Judges, you certainly see that the result of that. And then on into Kings and Samuel, you see there are remnants of the Canaanites that are still in the land, and they have a negative influence on the Israelites. And so you're right that what God said would happen, that if you don't drive them out, they will be a thorn in your side. And then he says, and it shall come about that as I plan to do to them, so I will do to you.
Yeah.
So they get driven out of the land.
I have a question about the land and the inheritance. Abraham looked north, south, east, and west, and God says, I'll give you this. But the Jordan seems to be this line of demarcation. They cross over, then they're in the land of Canaan, as if that's all they were promised. But then you look at David and Solomon's kingdom, and it's almost to Damascus. It's clear down to the Sinai. So where... I remember some talk about the Euphrates, as far as from the Euphrates to the Great Sea. So the guys that stayed over on the east side, and it was Moab, were they in violation of not going into the land, or were they in the land that was promised Abraham anyway? So all this relocation and migration back and forth across the Jordan's got me... Mm-hmm. Wondering what's going on there.
Mm-hmm. There are several descriptions of the land that are contained in the Old Testament, and they aren't all in sync. They don't all describe exactly the same plot of land. Now the ins and outs of that I don't know. I do think it's interesting here. It's talking about the land, describing the land. And apparently is not including the Transjordan area. I have wondered about that, the 2.5 tribes that settle in the Transjordan. Were they not supposed to do that? Was there something wrong with them doing that? And I'm not sure what the answer to that is. It doesn't look to me like there's any indication in the text that they are doing something wrong. But that land, if I remember my history correctly, that's some of the first land that's peeled off from Israelite control over the years. And there is constantly kind of a problem between the Transjordan Israelites and the Canaanite Israelites. There's always tension there. It shows up in Judges. So I think that's an interesting question. I'm not sure what to do with it. It doesn't look to me like it was wrong, but I'm not sure what's going on there. It's
And that's another question I had about the purpose of partitioning the land among the tribes with such sharp, clean definition. It seems that that would lead to the balkanization of the people, of the, rather than the melding of a people under the law.
Yeah. And that is what happens. That there are fissures that develop between the different tribes, and ultimately that's going to result in the separation of the northern kingdom from the southern kingdom. But it didn't have to be that way. And I think from the biblical perspective, there was supposed to be something that was so, that was held in common by all of them, that was so important that the little tensions that developed between the tribes would have been trivial. But that's not the way it played out historically.
Thank you.
Just a quick question.
Yeah.
On the cities that the Levites inherited, do you have any idea, were they just like little, how big were they? That's my question.
I don't know the answer to
that. Physically.
Right.
Would they be a quarter mile square? Would they be a half a mile square? You don't know.
I don't know. One of the commentators said, we have to remember these cities would have been quite small.
Yes.
It does say outside the walls of the city, a walled city
would be small.
There's a distinction between a village and a walled city. A walled city has to have a certain amount of size before they bother to put a wall around it. So it has a certain amount of size, but we're probably talking just a handful of thousand inhabitants. So it's not going to be very big. It's going to be one of the commentators was guessing, we're looking at something that's probably left less than a quarter, probably about a quarter of a mile across like that.
Because if it was a half a mile across,
yeah,
they would get two sections of land.
Yeah.
Is, I think if I figured it right.
Right.
So I was just kind of curious as to how much land they got.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know how much land they got, but I think we have to assume for them to get enough land to do anything of significance, the city has to be pretty small.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Thanks.